Part 4. Threshold. Chapter 16. Ormond Braxton chafed at being made to wait outside the golden doors of the Primarch's chambers. He would have expected better manners from a Primarch than to make a high-ranking emissary of the Administratum of Terror wait for so long. He had boarded the Pride of the Emperor 3 days ago, and such delays were the kind of thing he inflicted on others to demonstrate his superior rank. Finally, his petition for an audience had been approved, and his menials had bathed him, before Fulgrim's servants arrived to apply perfumed oils to his skin prior to bringing him before the Primarch. The scent of the oils was pleasing enough, though somewhat powerful for his ascetic tendencies. Sweat glistened on his bald pate and mingled with the oils to produce stinging droplets that irritated his eyes and caught in the back of his throat. A pair of elaborately armoured warriors stood to attention at the golden doors to Fulgrim's staterooms, beyond which Braxton could hear the deafening din of what he supposed was music, but sounded like an unmitigated racket to his ears. A pair of marble sculptures of wild curves and angles stood to either side of the guards, though what they were supposed to represent eluded Braxton's understanding. He adjusted his administrator robes around his shoulders while letting his attention drift to the paintings that filled this great terrazzo-floored hallway. The golden frames were elaborate to the point of ridiculousness, and the garish colours that filled them quite defied any aesthetic appreciation, though he admitted that his understanding of art was limited. Ormond Braxton had represented the Terran forces in the negotiations that had seen much of the solar system brought into compliance. He had been part of the delegation trained at the School of Iterators, and Evander Tobias and Kirill Sinderman were his close acquaintances. His exceptional skills as a negotiator and civil servant in the Terran Administrative Corps had ensured his selection for this mission, as it called for delicate diplomacy and tact. Only one of such stature could petition a Primarch, especially for such a task as was to be appointed him. At last, the doors to Fulgrim's staterooms were flung open, and booming peals of music spilled into the hall before the Primarch's chambers. The guard snapped to attention, and Braxton drew himself up to his full height as he prepared to enter into the presence of the Primarch of the Emperor's children. He awaited some signal that he was to go in, but nothing was forthcoming, and so he hesitantly stepped forward. The guards made no motion to stop him, so he carried on, his unease increasing as the doors swung closed behind him without apparent aid. The music was deafening. Dozens of phonocasters were scattered around, blaring a multitude of what appeared to be different kinds of music. Paintings of all manner of vileness hung from the walls, some depicting acts of violent barbarity and others of unspeakably vile conduct that was beyond pornography. Braxton felt his trepidation grow as he heard arguing voices from the central stateroom beyond. "My Lord Fulgrim," he inquired, "are you there? It is Administrator Ormond Braxton. I have come to see you from the Council of Terror." Instantly the voices ceased, and the phonocasters fell silent. Braxton glanced around him to see if he was alone, reckoning that the staterooms surrounding the central chamber were empty of life as far as he could see.
"You may enter,"
called a powerful musical voice from ahead. Braxton gingerly made his way towards the sound, fully expecting to see the Primarch and one of his loyal captains, though the argumentative tone of the voices still puzzled him. He stepped into the Primarch's central stateroom and pulled up short at the sight confronting him. Fulgrim, for the mighty physique could belong to none other, swept around his chambers, naked but for a purple loincloth, and brandishing a gleaming silver sword. His flesh was like hard marble, pale and veined with dark lines, and his face had a manic look to it, like that of a man in the grip of a chemical stimulant. The stateroom itself was a mess, with pieces of broken marble strewn around, and the walls chipped and stained with paint. A giant canvas stood at the far end of the chamber, though its angle prevented Braxton from seeing what manner of image was painted upon it. The odour of uneaten food hung heavy in the air, and not even the perfumed oils could mask the stench of rotten meat. "Emissary Braxton," cried Fulgrim, "how good of you to come!" Braxton covered his surprise at the state of the Primarch and his stateroom, and inclined his head.
"It is my honour to attend upon you, my lord."
"Nonsense," exclaimed Fulgrim. "I have been unforgivably rude in keeping you waiting, but I have been locked in council with my most trusted advisers in the week since our departure from the Purdus region." The Primarch towered over Braxton, and he felt the sheer physical intimidation of such a magnificent being threaten to overwhelm him, but he dug deep into his reserves of calm and found his voice once more.
"I come with tidings from Terra, and would deliver them to you, my lord."
"Of course, of course," said Fulgrim. "But first, my dear Braxton, would you do me an enormous favour?"
"I would be honoured to serve, my lord," said Braxton, noticing that Fulgrim's hands were discoloured as though from a fire. What heat could wound such a Primarch, he wondered. "What manner of favour would you have me do?"
Fulgrim spun his sword and put his hand on Braxton's shoulder, guiding him towards the vast canvas set up at the end of the stateroom. Fulgrim's pace practically forced Braxton to run, even though his generously fleshed form was unsuited to such a speed. He mopped his brow with a scented handkerchief as Fulgrim proudly stood him before the canvas and said, "What do you think of this, then? The likeness is quite uncanny, isn't it?" Braxton stared in open-mouthed horror at the image slathered on the canvas, a truly repellent portrait of an armoured warrior thickly painted with all manner of garish colours, crude brushstrokes and loathsome stench. The vastness of the image only served to heighten the horror of what it portrayed, for the subject was none other than the Primarch of the Emperor's children, so loathsomely delineated as to be insulting and degrading to one so awe-inspiring. Though he was no student of art, even Braxton recognised this as a vulgar atrocity, an affront to the being it purported to represent. He glanced over at Fulgrim to see if this was some elaborate jest, but the Primarch's face was rapt and unswerving in his adoration of the vile picture.
"You're lost for words, I can see," said Fulgrim. "I'm not surprised. It is, after all, by Serena D'Angelus, and only recently finished. You are honoured to see it before its public unveiling at the first performance of Mistress Kinska's Maraviglia in the newly refurbished La Fenice. That will be a night to remember, I can tell you."
Braxton nodded, too afraid of what he might say were he to open his mouth. The horror of the picture was too much to bear, its colours nauseating in a way that went beyond its simple crudity, and the stench of its surface was making his gorge rise. He moved away from the picture, pressing his handkerchief to his mouth and nose, as Fulgrim trailed behind him, idly swinging his sword in lazy circles.
"My lord, if I may," said Braxton.
"What?"
"Oh, yes, of course," said Fulgrim, as though listening to another voice entirely.
"You said something about news from Terra, didn't you?"
Recovering himself, Braxton said,
"Yes, my lord, from the mouth of the Sigillite himself."
"So what does old Malkador have to say for himself?" asked Fulgrim.
And Braxton was shocked at the informality and lack of respect inherent in the Primarch's tone.
"Firstly, I bring word of Lord Magnus of Prospero. It has come to the attention of the Emperor, beloved by all, that contrary to the dictates of the Council of Nicaea, Lord Magnus has continued his researches into the mysteries of the Immaterium."
Fulgrim nodded to himself as he began pacing once more and said,
I knew he would, but the others were too blind to see it. Even with the new chaplains in place, I suspected Magnus would backslide. He does love his mysteries.
Quite, agreed Braxton. The Sigillite has dispatched the wolves of Fenris to bring Magnus back to Terra to await the Emperor's judgment upon him.
Fulgrim paused, turning to face the vile painting once more, and shook his head as though disagreeing with some unseen interrogator.
"Then Magnus is to be... what? Charged with a crime?" asked Fulgrim heatedly, as though his anger at the messenger would somehow change the facts.
"I do not know any more, my lord," replied Braxton, "simply that he is to return to Terra with Leman Russ of the Space Wolves."
Fulgrim nodded, though he was clearly unhappy at such a development, and said,
"You said, firstly, what other news do you bring?"
Braxton knew that he would have to choose his words carefully, for there was more that would yet displease the Primarch.
"I bring news concerning the conduct within one of your brother Primarch's legions."
Fulgrim ceased his pacing and looked up in sudden interest.
"It is Horus's legion."
Braxton covered his irritation and nodded.
"It is. Have you already heard my news?"
Fulgrim shook his head.
"No, I was just guessing. Go on and tell me your news, but be aware that Horus is my sworn brother, and I will brook no disrespect of him."
"Of course not," confirmed Braxton. "At present, the 63rd Expedition makes war against a civilization calling itself the Orishan Technocracy. Horus came in the name of peace, but the misguided..."
"The War Master," put in Fulgrim.
And Braxton cursed himself for making such an elementary error. The Astartes detested mortals showing a lack of respect for their position.
"My apologies," continued Braxton smoothly. "The rulers of these planets attempted to assassinate the War Master, and thus he declared a legal war upon them to bring their worlds to compliance. In this matter he has been aided by Lord Angron of the 7th Legion."
Fulgrim laughed.
"Then I don't hold out much hope for there being much left of this technocracy at the end of the war."
"Quite," said Braxton. "Lord Angron's excesses, shall we say, are not unknown to the Council of Terra, but we have received some unsettling reports from Lord Commander Hector Varvarus, commander of the army units within the 63rd Expedition."
"Reports of what?" demanded Fulgrim.
Braxton was unnerved to see that the Primarch's previous manic distraction appeared to have quite vanished.
"Reports of a massacre perpetrated by Astartes against Imperial civilians, my lord."
"Nonsense," snapped Fulgrim. "Angron may be many things, but massacring Imperial citizens seems a little out of character even for him. Wouldn't you say?"
"Reports have reached Terra regarding Lord Angron's conduct in the war, it's true," said Braxton, keeping his tone as neutral as possible, "though it is not of him that I speak."
"Horus?" asked Fulgrim, his voice hoarse, and Braxton saw what in a mortal he would have regarded as fear in his dark eyes. "What has happened?"
Braxton paused before continuing. He noted that there was no denial, as there had been when Fulgrim had thought Angron accused.
"It appears that the War Master was grievously wounded on the planet of Davin, and some of his warriors were somewhat overzealous when bringing him back on board the Vengeful Spirit."
"Overzealous?" barked Fulgrim. "Speak plainly, man. What does that mean?"
"A sizable crowd had gathered on the embarkation decks of the War Master's flagship, and when the Astartes came back on board, they smote the crowd in their haste to reach the Medicaid decks. Some 21 people are dead, and many more grievously injured."
"And you blame Horus for this?"
"It is not my place to assign blame, my lord," said Braxton. "I am merely informing you of the facts."
Fulgrim rounded on him suddenly. Braxton felt his bladder loosen and a warmth trickle down his leg as the wild-eyed Primarch of the Emperor's children towered over him, with his sword suddenly raised above his head as if to strike him down.
"Facts!" snarled Fulgrim. "What does a foppish scribe such as you know of the facts of war? War is hard, fast, and cruel. Horus knows this, and he fights accordingly. If people are stupid enough to get in the way of that, then their own foolishness is to blame."
Ormond Braxton had seen much in the way of egotism in his time within the civil administration of Terra, but he had never been faced with such barefaced arrogance and callous dismissal of human life.
"My lord," gasped Braxton, "people are dead, killed by the Astartes. Such things will not just go away. Those responsible must be called to account, or the ideals of the Great Crusade will stand for nothing."
Fulgrim lowered his sword, appearing only now to notice its presence. He shook his head and smiled, his ephemeral anger vanishing in the space of a moment.
"You are right, of course, my dear Braxton. I apologize for my uncivil behavior and beg of your pardon. I am much vexed by the pain of wounds suffered battling an alien monstrosity in our previous campaign, and my temper is a fragile thing as a result."
"No pardon is necessary, my lord," said Braxton slowly. "I understand your brotherhood with the War Master, and it is for that very reason that I am dispatched to you. The Council of Terra wishes you to travel to Aureus and meet with the War Master to ensure that the principles that underpin the Great Crusade are being adhered to."
Fulgrim snorted in derision and turned away.
"So now we must fight with an eye forever over our shoulder. Are we not trusted to make war? You civilians want your conquests, but you do not care for how they are won, do you? War is brutality, and the more brutal it is, the sooner it is over. But that's not good enough for you, is it? In your eyes, wars must be fought according to an imperfect set of rules imposed by those who have never seen a shot fired in anger or risked their own blood alongside their brothers. Know this, Braxton. Every petty restrictive rule you civilians impose on our method of war means that more of my warriors die."
Braxton was shocked by Fulgrim's bitterness, but hid his surprise.
"What response should I take back to the Council of Terra, my lord?"
Again Fulgrim's anger seemed to melt away in the face of reason, and the mighty Primarch laughed humorlessly.
"Tell them, Master Braxton, that I shall lead my warriors to join the 63rd expedition, that I will examine how my brother makes war, and that I shall be sure to tell you all about it."
The sarcasm was heavy in Fulgrim's tone, but Braxton ignored it and bowed.
"Then, my lord, if I may take my leave..."
Fulgrim waved his hand dismissively and nodded.
"Yes, go. Return to your courtiers and scriveners, and tell them that the Lord Fulgrim will do their bidding."
Braxton bowed once more and backed away from the barely dressed Primarch. When he had retreated a sufficient distance, he turned and made his way through the golden doors that led to normality. Behind him, he could hear voices arguing, and he risked a glance over his shoulder in an attempt to identify with whom Fulgrim spoke. He felt a shiver travel the length of his spine as he saw that Fulgrim was alone. He was speaking to the loathsome painting.
"What are you doing?"
asked a voice behind her, and she froze. Serena clutched the knife to her breast as her mind raced to identify the questioner. In her fevered thoughts, she imagined that it was Ostian, come once again to save her. But when the question was asked again, she blinked and dropped the knife as she recognized that the speaker was the Astartes warrior, Lucius. Her breathing was heavy, and her blood was pounding as she looked down at the corpse lying next to the unfinished picture of the swordsman. She couldn't recall the dead man's name, an irony she found amusing, given her official title as Remembrancer. But he had been a talented composer once. Now he was raw material for her work, his blood pumping enthusiastically onto the floor from his opened throat. The metallic smell of his blood filled her nostrils as she felt a hand grasp her shoulder and turn her around. She looked up into Lucius's boyish face, his handsome features marred forever by the crooked twist of his nose where it had been broken in some combat. She reached up with a bloodied hand to touch his face, and his eyes followed her fingers as they traced the line of his jaw.
"What happened here?" asked Lucius, nodding towards the corpse. "That man is dead."
"Yes," said Serena, slumping to the floor. "I killed him."
"Why?" asked Lucius.
Even in her fugue state, Serena detected an interest beyond that which would normally be aroused by such a discovery. What remained of the rational part of her mind understood the precariousness of the situation, and she covered her face with her hands and began to weep uncontrollably, hoping the onset of tears would trigger the male comfort reaction. Lucius let her weep, and she cried,
"He tried to rape me."
"Rape you?" asked Lucius aghast. "What?"
"He tried to force himself upon me, and I killed him. I fought him, but he was too strong. He hit me, and I reached out to grab the first thing I could find to use as a weapon. I suppose I must have picked up my knife, and..."
"And you killed him," finished Lucius. Serena looked up through her tears, hearing no condemnation in Lucius's tone.
"Yes, I killed him."
"Then the bastard got what he deserved," said Lucius, pulling Serena to her feet. "He tried to violate you, and you defended yourself, yes?"
Serena nodded. The exhilaration of lying to this warrior who could snap her neck with his fingers, sending warm rushes of pleasure through her entire body.
"I met him in La Fenice, and he said he wanted to see some of my work," she gasped,
already knowing that Lucius would not arrest her or otherwise call her to account for the killing.
"It was foolish, I know, but he seemed genuinely interested. When we returned to my studio..."
"He turned on you?"
"Yes," nodded Serena. "And now he's dead. Oh, Lucius, what am I going to do?"
"Don't worry," said Lucius. "This won't need to go any further. I'll have some servitors dispose of his remains, and this can all be forgotten about."
Serena threw herself against Lucius in gratitude and let her tears come once more, feeling nothing but contempt for this man and his belief that such a traumatic event, had it been real, could be forgotten about so easily. She pushed herself from his breastplate and bent to pick up her knife. The blade was still wet with blood, and the cold steel glittered invitingly in the light. Without conscious thought, she reached up and sliced the blade across her cheek, drawing a thin line of blood from her pallid skin. Lucius watched her impassively and asked,
"What did you do that for?"
"So that I don't forget what happened," she said, handing him the knife and rolling up her sleeves to show the many scars and fresh cuts in the flesh of her arms. "Pain is my way of remembering all that has gone before. If I hold on to that pain, then I will never allow it to be forgotten."
Lucius nodded and reached up to slowly run his fingertips over the crooked line of his nose. Serena could see the anger and hurt pride within him at the marring of his perfect features. A strange sensation of power filled her, as though her words carried more than meaning in their sounds, an influence beyond understanding. She felt this power flow through her and into the very air, filling the space between them with unknown potential.
"What happened to your face?" asked Serena, unwilling to lose this remarkable sensation.
"A barbaric son of a bitch named Loken broke it when he cheated in a fair fight."
"He wounded you, didn't he?"
she asked, the sound of her words flowing like honey in his ears.
"More than just physically, I mean."
"Yes," said Lucius, his voice hollow. "He destroyed my perfection."
You'd want to hurt him, wouldn't you?
I'll see him dead soon, swore Lucius.
Serena smiled, reaching out and placing her hands on his. Yes, I know you will.
He gripped the knife tightly and she lifted his unresisting hand to his face.
Yes, she said with a nod. Your perfect face is already gone forever.
Do it.
He returned her nod and with a quick flick of his wrist cut deeply into the flawless skin of his cheek. He flinched at the pain but lifted the dripping knife to cut an identical line across the opposite cheek.
Now you will never forget this, Loken, she said.
Fulgrim paced the confines of his staterooms, marching from room to room as he pondered the words of emissary Braxton. He had tried to conceal his unease at the news he had been brought, but he suspected that the man had seen through his facade of indifference. He swung the silver sword in a glittering arc, its blade cutting the air with a sound like ripping cloth. Try as he might to forget them, the words of the Eldar Farseer kept returning, and though he had tried to purge the alien's lies from his head, they would not leave him alone. Braxton's news of the Council of Terror's desire for him to investigate Horus and Angron's conduct only heightened his fear that the Farseer had spoken the truth.
It cannot be true, shouted Fulgrim. Horus would never betray the Emperor.
Are you so sure?
Asked the voice, and Fulgrim felt the familiar jolt of unease as it spoke. He could no longer delude himself that this was simply the voice of his own conscience, but was something else entirely. Since the portrait had been delivered to his stateroom, the honest counsellor in his head had, by some unknown means, relocated itself within the thick paints of the canvas, reshaping the image to suit its vocabulary. Fulgrim marvelled at his ability to simply accept this development, and each time the hideousness of the notion surfaced in his mind, it was quashed by a feeling of elation and attraction that melted his concerns like snow before the spring sun. He turned slowly towards the magnificent picture Serena D'Angelis had painted for him, its splendour matched only by his amazement at what it had become in the days since it had been delivered to his staterooms. Fulgrim made his way through the ruin of his quarters and stared into the image of his own face on the canvas. The giant in purple armour stared at him from the picture, its features refined and regal, the mirror of his own. The eyes sparkled as though recalling some long-forgotten joke. The lips curled in the curved wrinkle of the hypocrite, and the brow furrowed as though plotting some scheme of great cunning. Even as he stared into his own features, the mouth twisted and pulled at the canvas as it formed new words.
What if the alien spoke true? If Horus has indeed forsaken the Emperor, where would you stand in such a contest?
Fulgrim felt clammy sweat coat his naked flesh, repulsed by the creeping horror of the picture, yet unaccountably drawn once again to hear its words, as though they possessed some silken, siren-like attraction to him. As much as he wanted to slice his blade through the painting, he could not bear to see it destroyed.
He is the most worthy of you, said the painting, its mouth contorting under the effort of speech. If Horus were to turn his face from the Emperor, where would you stand?
The question is immaterial, snapped Fulgrim. The situation would never arise.
Think you so? Laughed the painting. Even now Horus plants the seeds of his rebellion.
Fulgrim clenched his jaw and aimed his sword at the image of himself on the canvas. I will not believe you, he shouted. You cannot know these things.
But I do.
How? Begged Fulgrim. You are not me. You cannot be me.
No, agreed his twin. I am not. Call me the spirit of perfection that will guide you in the coming days.
Horace seeks war with the Emperor? Asked Fulgrim, almost unable to speak the words, such was the horror of what they represented. He does not seek it, but it is forced upon him. The Emperor plans to abandon you all, Fulgrim. His perfection is naught but a sham. He has used you all to conquer the galaxy for him, and now seeks to ascend to godhood on the blood you have shed.
No, cried Fulgrim, I won't believe this. The Emperor is human intelligence raised above all error and imperfection and extended to all possible truth.
Your belief is irrelevant. It is already happening. Grand things are necessarily obscure to weak men. That which can be made explicit to the idiot is not worth my care. If Horus can see this, how is it that you, most perfect of Primarchs, cannot?
Because you are lying, bellowed Fulgrim, smashing his fist into one of the green marble pillars that supported the domed roof of his staterooms. Powdered stone exploded from the column, and it collapsed in a cracked pile of splintered rock.
You waste time in denial, Fulgrim. You are already on the road to joining your brother.
I will support Horus in all things, gasped Fulgrim. But turn against the Emperor! That is too far!
You will never know what is too far until you go beyond it. I know you, Fulgrim, and have tasted the forbidden desires you hold chained within the deepest, darkest recesses of your soul. Better to murder an infant in its cradle than nurse an unacted-upon desire.
No, said Fulgrim, raising his bloodied hand to his temple. I won't listen to you.
Expose yourself to your deepest fear, Fulgrim. After that, fear has no power, and the fear of freedom shrinks and vanishes. You will be free.
Free? Cried Fulgrim. Betrayal is not freedom, it is damnation.
Damnation? No, it is liberty and unfettered freedom to explore all that is and all that can be. Horus has seen beyond the veil of this mortal flesh you call life and learnt the truth of your existence. He is privy to the secrets of the ancients, and only he can help you towards perfection.
Perfection? Whispered Fulgrim.
Yes. Perfection. The Emperor is imperfect, for if he were perfect, then such things could not happen. Perfection is slow death. Only change is constant, the signal for rebirth, the egg of the phoenix from which you arise. Ask yourself this. What is it you fear?
Fulgrim stared into the eyes of the portrait, eyes that were his own, but for the awful knowledge within them. With a clarity born of perfect understanding, Fulgrim knew the answer to the question his reflection had posed him.
My fear is to fail, said Fulgrim.
The cold lights of the apothecarium were bright and hostile, staring down at Marius as he lay naked on the surgical slab. His limbs were immobile, held static by gleaming steel restraints and chemical inhibitors. The feeling of vulnerability was acute, but he had vowed to obey his Primarch's orders, no matter what they were, and Lord Eidolon had assured him that this was what Lord Fulgrim desired.
Are you ready? Asked Fabius, the silver steel arms of the apothecary's chirurgeon machine looming over him like a great spider.
Marius tried to nod, but his muscles would not obey him.
I am, he said, fighting to say even that.
Excellent, said Fabius.
His narrow dark eyes bored into Marius and examined his flesh, as a butcher might examine a choice cut of meat, or a sculptor a fresh block of virgin stone.
Lord Commander Eidolon said you would make me better than before.
"And so I shall, Captain Verosian," grinned Fabius. "You will not believe the things I can do."